Hello and welcome to Stick Together, Australia's only national radio show dedicated to workplace and social justice issues. Stick Together is produced in the studios at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne and broadcast nationally via the Community Radio Network. My name's Annie McLaughlin. It may not be very surprising to realise that the Abbott government is trying to push through the Senate laws that stack the balance of power into the hands of the employers with the specific aim of reducing work conditions. Jed Carney, ACTU president, recently sent out a call to action saying that workers need to let the senators know that they should vote against the Abbott government's agenda to bring back individual contract, the giving to employers a veto over industrial action, and reducing workers' rights to speak to their union at work if they need help. Part of the package of work laws the senators are to vote on Wednesday, the September the 3rd, is a new building code which singles out the construction industry for special treatment when it comes to Abbott government's approach to industrial relations. But for some, it is a light into the future for all workers in Australia under an Abbott government.
Anything, mate?
No. Nothing yet. I feel like I'm never going to get qualified.
Yeah, well, I'm sure things are going to be all right.
Not unless I get another job.
Well, just got to keep trying, mate.
I am trying, Dad.
According to the Abbott government's proposed building code, a builder will be banned from government jobs if he commits in an agreement to employ apprentices on any of his projects, even non-government jobs.
Yeah, okay. All right, no worries, thanks. Okay, catch you. Bye.
So?
No, go again, love. Too old.
What, 40 years' experience doesn't mean anything anymore?
No. Don't worry, something will turn up.
Yeah, well, I'm not that convinced.
Tony Abbott's proposed building code bans builders who have agreed with a union to employ more mature, experienced workers, even on non-government jobs.
Good kick.
Hi, honey.
Hey.
She's been out there all day.
Uh-huh. Pick it up.
You know she's got Auskick this Sunday.
Yeah.
Can you make it?
They're making me work again.
That's 4 weekends in a row now.
What am I supposed to do? It's the new rules.
Well, what's more important?
Dad, look at this!
I spoke to Troy Gray, Victorian Branch Secretary of the ETU, to ask him about Abbott's new building code.
We commenced negotiations around about 6 months ago, shortly after commencing those negotiations with the National Electrical Contractors Association. The government handed down their new proposed guidelines for the code. Now, the guidelines are retrospective, so any new agreement that we do, or any worker does, or any employer does, if the code gets up in the Senate, needs to be code compliant. The one condition in the guidelines of the code that's been handed down that goes along the lines that says that any provision that prevents an employer going about their business is non-code compliant. Now, 3 months ago, we said, well, what does that actually mean? So we wrote to the department and we asked the department, well, the guidelines have been handed down. Can you please vet our agreement? and tell us which clauses are, in your eyes, are non-co-compliant. We still haven't received formal correspondence from the department. However, they did give correspondence to the National Electrical Contractors Association, who we're negotiating with. Out of the 90-odd clauses in the agreement, it outlaws, if the new code gets through the Senate and comes into force, 76 of those 90 clauses. A number of those clauses regulate your hours of work. They regulate and gazette your rostered days off. They enable you to have time off at Easter and Christmas with your families. They enable you to know when overtime kicks in.
What they're saying is that they want to make sure that they've got a new code that says that there should be no restrictive work practices or discriminatory provisions. And that means that you as a union or workers cannot negotiate anything with the boss.
Well, it goes further than that. We demanded some more explanation from Senator Betts, and I understand our National Secretary met with Senator Betts last week. Straight to the point, there should be no restrictions whatsoever on business. And that's where they're coming from. And industrial agreements, Annie, are very important things. They not only govern your wages, conditions and health and safety at work, but they do dictate your living standards and your family time outside of work. So they are very important documents to millions of workers in Australia. And to have a proposed code that basically guts the agreement and enables employers to have workers at their beck and will, any day of the week, Saturdays and Sundays, it'll be treated no different. Rostered days off cannot be designated or gazetted. It has a horrendous effect. There's a number of clauses in the agreement that the new code outlaws about relocation to unsafe areas and the rights to have a health and safety rep and the rights to have access to your union if there's an issue, all outlawed by the code. And we don't put these clauses in, and we haven't campaigned, and we haven't had agreement of the bosses in the past just for fun. These clauses are adopted by the industry to give the workers some decent rights. Now, the government's argument again for the code, or to justify the new proposed code, is of the poor productivity. Well, the Australian Institute recent report that came out blows that out of the water. So we'd argue now, what is the need for this code? And we'd call on all senators to see through this for what it is, and to knock off this code to protect the 1 million construction workers that work in the construction industry in Australia. Part of the overall agenda of this government, we thought the budget was bad, and that should be resisted and opposed, but this new code for the construction industry will have a more dramatic effect than any budget measure will have on the living standards of construction workers.
Would you say that this is like a test case for their general position with workers overall?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they believe in the free market. It's a free market from an economic point of view, but workers need to have their hands tied is the way that they like it. So they don't believe in industrial agreements. They don't believe that workers should have provisions that protect their health and safety, minimum working hours. They don't believe that there's any difference between a Saturday and a Sunday and minimum rates of pay and all the rest of it that go into these industrial agreements. You know, this is a government that I might add that said before they were elected, if you vote for us, we will not have any industrial relation changes in the first term. Well, this is not work choices. This is much, much worse than work choices for construction workers. And we need to get it out there. You know, the focus at the moment is all about the budget, and that's fair enough. You know, there's some horrendous things in the budget, but yeah, you know, one of our concerns is, and that's why we're lobbying all senators and trying to communicate as broadly as we can, that if this code gets up, it will wind back the clock decades from a wages, conditions and living standards point of view for construction workers, and it will put directly at risk their health and safety on the job.
Contractors will be covered by the code prospectively from the first time they tender for Commonwealth-funded building work after the new code commences.
Yep.
And once the code, a contractor is covered by the Fair and Lawful Building Sites Code, it will be required to act consistently with it, including on future privately funded work. So not just for government construction work, but they're expecting that this will cover for work in privately funded construction. How can they do that?
Very good question. We'd ask the same. We'd ask that exact question, Annie. The scope of the bill and the code is all encompassing. So, if you have a company that may just want to work on the Bendigo Hospital, and the rest of that company's work is domestic, private sector work. That agreement must be, if this code gets up, co-compliant, and that agreement will cover your private work and your other commercial work. Not only that, some of the major companies that we work for, they'll have an electrical division, a mechanical division, a rail and transport division, a number of divisions. If that one electrical division works on a government job, then not only does that one electrical division need to be co-compliant, but all the divisions, and this is nationwide, and we have many companies that have, like, you know, rail infrastructure divisions in Queensland, they also have to be co-compliant. So when we say that this code covers, and there is, and it's proven there's over 1 million workers in the Australian construction industry, this code goes a lot further than that. This goes right into the private sector, and it's just the quickest vehicle to gut the working conditions of working people that I've seen in the 25 years of representing workers. There's the budget, there's the 457 visa issue, there's the code, there's the ABCC, there's the issue about closing down TAFEs. We need to come together and we need to campaign strong to tackle these Conservative governments head on. You know, we're going to have a code campaign, we're having a budget campaign, we're having industrial campaigns, we can have all these mini campaigns, but there's one campaign that we all have to have, and that's to get rid of the Napthine government and then follow that on with getting rid of the Abbott government, and then try and restore some workers' rights with whatever we've got left after that. So I urge everybody to head in that direction and we'll help lead the way.
You are listening to Stick Together, the only national radio program devoted to industrial news and social justice issues. Before we leave the issue of the new version of Work Choices going to the Senate on Wednesday, September the 3rd, if you are listening to this show on Wednesday, you have the chance to let the senators know your feelings by going to www.australiannewsnation.org/stop_tony_abbotts_anti_workers_laws. That address again, www.australiannewsnation.org/stop_tony_abbotts_anti_workers_laws.
Stick together.
You're listening to Stick Together on Community Radio.
National unemployment figures are on the rise, with youth unemployment reaching frightening heights. The Victorian Council of Social Service, VCOS, recently released a report that showed youth unemployment in Victoria running at a 15-year high. I spoke to Emma King, Chief Executive Officer at VCOS, to find out what is happening and what action VCOS believes needs to be taken.
Victoria's youth unemployment rate has worsened sharply in the first half of this year, this calendar year. So it's now at its highest monthly average rate in 15 years. As a consequence, we're seeing over 75,000 young Victorians, that's Victorians aged between 15 and 24, 75,000 young Victorians who are now out of work and actively looking for work. So we're seeing quite alarming figures, because we know that overall the percentage is very high, but it's certainly concentrated in particular areas. So when we look at particular regions, such as Warrnambool in the southwest, Bendigo, Geelong, Shepparton, as well as the northwestern suburbs of Melbourne, we're seeing an absolute concentration of social disadvantage in those areas. VCOS has called for, within our state election plan, we've called for community, business and government to develop a comprehensive workforce participation plan. We know that if we don't start to stimulate economic growth, fundamentally our young people are going to be in absolute strife. So we know that we need to work together to develop a solution, and we do need government leadership in that area. Or a question I'd be asking if I was a young person is, where are the jobs? So given that we've already got an unemployment rate overall of 7%, we know that young people are out there in the marketplace and they're competing against more experienced workers. So some of the jobs that would have traditionally fallen to young people or been within the reach of young people are now out of reach, and it's incredibly difficult for young people to get that first foothold in the labour force. We've got to do everything we can to turn that around and give them the chances that they deserve. We are particularly concerned in terms of the funding that has been taken out of TAFE, and we absolutely do believe that that is a contributing factor when we look at youth unemployment. We know that the fees for people to attend TAFE, if they're looking for their second qualification, etc., are in fact a deterrent for people to attend TAFE, and we know that TAFEs are in themselves are now in extremely difficult financial situations as well. There's a number of other things, though, that are yet to come. So we think these figures are only going to become worse. So, for example, when we look at the Youth Connections program that currently has a very high success rate of putting young people into either employment or education, and they're there still 6 months after they've completed the program. So that's got about a 93% success rate. That's going to be defunded from the end of this calendar year, and yet we're seeing significant investment in the Work for the Dole program, which has about a 22% success rate. So we're seeing funding being taken away from the programs that work, and it's being geared towards the programs that don't work. In addition to that, we're looking at a federal government that's looking to implement budget measures that are going to take income off young people for 6 months of every year. And remembering within that context or the definition of young people, the federal government is seeking to change that. So at the moment, we're looking at 15 to 24-year-olds. The federal government is looking to change that definition to anyone under 30. So if you are under 30 and the federal government gets its proposed budget measures through and you're not able to find a job through no fault of your own, you'll be without income for 6 months of every year. And I simply don't know how people are meant to live on fresh air alone.
Other issues that seem to be cropping up, a reduced number of apprentices that are being supported by the government system. Are you seeing some spin-off with that?
I think there's been quite a bit of publicity today in terms of the reduced number of apprenticeships. Again, inevitably that'll have contributed towards these figures. So that's new data that's come out over the last few days, and we believe that that will have contributed to these figures as well. You know, I think back, I was a teacher many years ago now, and I think back to even then we saw a shift towards kids really needing to finish Year 12 to get an apprenticeship, when in prior years they may well have picked up that apprenticeship if they left school at about Year 10. We know now for those early school leavers, it's very, very difficult for them to pick up another job or to pick up a job at all, leaving with a lower level of educational attainment. So it is a priority to keep young people in school or in education for as long as we can, and we know within that that education sometimes needs to look a bit different. It might not be within a formal school setting, but it's critical to keep young people in education whilst we can, because it gives them the best chance of going out and getting a job. But at the moment, really, one of the key questions really is, where are the jobs? And if you're a young person and you're looking for a job, I suspect the question will be, well, where are the jobs? And we saw in The Age earlier this week the case studies of a couple of people who've been looking for hundreds of jobs, and they've even received very few interviews out of that. So we're seeing highly motivated young people who can very quickly become very disillusioned.
Are you really implying that the government needs to pull its socks up?
Yes, we absolutely are. We work with community sector organisations that work with young people at the coalface, work incredibly hard to try and get them into jobs or education, and they tell us the stories of the young people who are doing it incredibly hard out there and are doing their best to try and get a job every day of the week. They talk to us about the early school leavers whom, despite their best efforts, are finding it incredibly difficult. We had one provider in Geelong speaking to us about the number of young school leavers who just simply can't get jobs. They can't compete in a workforce, particularly one in Geelong where we've seen recent job losses of quite a significant scale. It's really tough in that environment to be able to pick up a job at the best of times, and if you're someone who's left school, have a Year 10 completion, to be able to compete in that market is incredibly difficult, and young people simply aren't picking up jobs.
It's quite interesting to look at, say, Tasmanian government websites that talk about their centrepiece of their youth unemployment program is Work for the Dole. I mean, if there are jobs in Work for the Dole, then why aren't people being paid a proper rate for them?
Oh, look, I think that's exactly right. If there are jobs, let's recruit people into those jobs and give them some experience in working. We know, as I said earlier, we know that work for the dole doesn't work. We think that really it's an ideological stance, that the figures are there to show that it doesn't work. It's an ideological stance, and the whole concept of work for the dole suggests there's a whole lot of people out there who are bludging on the couch and can't be bothered to get up and go to work. We know that that isn't the case. And in fact, let's look at what opportunities there are there to work and give people those opportunities. And in fact, let's look at how we stimulate our broader economy to create more jobs and more opportunities for young people. And in doing that, at the same time, we need a strong safety net. We know that young people, as all people who are out of work, need secure and affordable housing, and they need a strong social safety net that they can fall back on. We are incredibly concerned that the priority of the federal government is to take that social net away, and we know that is going to be absolutely devastating, not only for young people, but also for our broader society. It's really going to tear at the social fabric of our society, and I think lead towards a type of Australia that we don't want and is actually morally corrupt.
Are we in a really dangerous place at the moment in Australia?
We are. If you look at the proposed federal budget measures, we are absolutely at a dangerous place in Australia. And this is a time where we've got to take, there's some very real choices to be made here, and we are absolutely calling on all members of our community to contact the federal government and to lobby them in terms of pointing out what the impacts of the proposed federal budget changes will be. So when we look at the federal education minister proposing that university fees be deregulated and suggesting that's not akin to giving one of their kidneys, the reality is he's seeking to put fees up further, to put them out of reach of those who may already be disadvantaged and vulnerable that want to engage in study and they want to improve their life opportunities. And then once education is out of reach for them and they can't get a job, they're then going to be without income for 6 months of every year. You know, it defies comprehension.
You're listening to Stick Together, and our last report today concerns student unions. The Macquarie University has taken the representatives of the Macquarie University Postgraduate Association, the only genuinely elected union on campus, to court in order to get a court order to wind the association up, take the $500,000 it has in the bank, and appoint a university-appointed advisory committee to replace it, citing that the Postgraduate Association has not been doing its job of representing students. I spoke to Megan Hopper, the president of the Council of Australian Postgraduate Associations, to shed some light on the situation.
So Macquarie University Postgraduate Representative Association is one of the longest running postgraduate organisations in the country. It's been around since 1997, and over the last 2 to 3 years, the university has been trying to wind the organisation up. They say that they've replaced the organisation with a student advisory board, but in fact the student advisory board is little more than, I guess, a committee that sort of speaks to the university and gives them advice but doesn't actually represent students. Its chair is not directly elected by students, so the function it performs is not the same as a student union, which is what MUPRA was performing. So the university is taking the 7 elected members of the executive of the Macquarie University Postgraduate Representative Association to court, and they're doing that to ask the court to forcibly wind up the Postgraduate Association, and they're also seeking the money that the Postgraduate Association has in a savings account, which is about $500,000, and they're seeking legal costs. So it's quite a big deal. It's quite an enormous situation for the 7 students involved, but we think it will also have a dramatic impact on the relationship between student unions and universities more broadly across Australia.
And I guess it should be cleared up, the fact that the representatives are actually being, taken to court individually because it's not an incorporated body.
That's right. So the Student Association is not an incorporated body. And so what that means is that the 7 postgraduate students who have been elected to represent their fellow postgrads, and 2 of those are international students, those seven students are being taken to court as individuals by the university where they're studying. So it's very disappointing. Obviously, these students are incredibly distressed. They're very confused about what's going on, about all of the legal aspects of this. And so the organisation that I'm president of, the Council of Australian Postgraduate Associations, we're really just trying to help them navigate this legal minefield and let people in public know that this is something that Macquarie University is doing to seven of its own students.
Why is Macquarie University able to even do this?
Look, I think because the organisation was initially set up in 1997 through the university and through an agreement with the university, but look, there are a lot of weaknesses to the case, and that's something that we'll be fighting very hard in court when it goes to the Supreme Court, is just, you know, their ability to actually step in and say, we've decided to set up a completely different student association, it's a representative body where the chair is not elected, and we feel that it replaces a student union that's been in operation since 1997, so we're going to close you down, take your $500,000 in savings, and charge you legal costs. At the same time, it really does seem like it's something they shouldn't be able to do. The advice that we've received from our pro bono legal representation so far is that they feel that we have a pretty strong argument to put on behalf of the postgraduate representatives here. Yeah, I really just don't understand why the university thinks that they can do this.
Why are they doing it now?
They're doing it. The student services and amenities fee, which came in a couple of years ago, basically changed the way that universities fund student organisations. And so universities are required to have student representatives of some description to negotiate with in regard to student funding. By putting in a student advisory board that's chaired by a person selected by the university, that's the university's way of getting around negotiating with an independent student elected committee of postgraduate students around how that funding's allocated. So basically by getting rid of MUPRA and by taking their funds back and spending that on completely separate activities, they actually want to take that $500,000 that's in savings and spend it on student scholarships for postgraduates. By doing that, it means that it's easier for them to sort of determine where the student services and amenities fee funding is going to go. So this is very much a test case on the future of student services and amenities fee at universities across Australia and how universities choose to provide that to student unions and student bodies.
That's it for Stick Together this week. Thanks to you for listening in. Stick Together is produced at 3CR Studios in Melbourne and broadcast nationally on the Community Radio Network. The podcast is available at 3cr.org.au and you can contact the producers of the show at stick.together@gmail.com. You can also go to our Facebook page. Thanks to Troy Gray from the ETU, Emma King from VCOS and Megan Hopper from Kappa for talking to us today. My name's Annie McLaughlin. Catch you next time.